Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Cliff Gardner. I represent the appellant, James O'Malley. I'd like to use my time today to discuss two of the issues referenced in my focus letter. I'd like to start with the Batson issue, and particularly I'd like to talk about prospective juror Carey, the discharge of prospective juror Carey. And time permitting, I'd like to talk a little bit about the retained counsel issue, the question of whether Mr. O'Malley in fact did ask to discharge retained counsel. And so I'd like to start with the Batson issue, again, with respect to prospective juror Carey. On defendant's Batson motion, defense counsel's Batson motion, the prosecutor stated a number of reasons for discharging prospective juror Carey. And the court is, I'm sure, familiar with the briefs. We're in a relatively typical situation. I've discussed them, the attorney general has discussed them, and in fact, we disagree about every single one of them. And so I thought I could use my time profitably today to take them one by one. And I have some thoughts to share with the court on each of them. So let's start in connection with prospective juror Carey with the prosecutor's statement that one of the reasons for discharging prospective juror Carey was that he, quote, recalled and spoke of prejudice. Now, on this matter, we actually agree. It is completely unsupported by the record. There was nothing in prospective juror Carey's juror questionnaire, and there was nothing in the voir dire that supported that statement by the prosecutor. And so the state's response is to recognize that it's unsupported, but suggest that it was a mistake. And I have a couple of thoughts on this. First, let me start with a concession, is that it is true the cases have recognized that a race-neutral and genuine mistake can support the strike of a juror. Having conceded that, I think my colleague on the other side of the podium would have to concede that the cases also recognize that sometimes when a prosecutor states a reason that isn't supported by the record, it's evidence of pretext. And so the question is,
is there a middle ground that that the rule should be that a prosecutor errs and says, I excused him because he thinks the moon is made of green cheese, and in fact that was a different juror, that on review we should simply excise that reason and see if there are other reasons that stand to reason to support the excusal? And the reason I ask it that way, Mr. Gardner, is that it seems harsh to me to say that if a person makes an honest mistake, well, they must be a liar and a racist. Because that's the essence of the Wheeler-Batson holding, that the DA didn't have a legitimate reason for the excusal and lied about it, and was in fact motivated by bigotry, which the law will not tolerate. So is there some middle ground here?
Well, I think the middle ground here, I appreciate the concern, and it is true. The last thing we would want to do is require a reversal when in fact it's an innocent and race-neutral mistake. Mistakes happen. These are long trials. You can misstate or you can recall something differently. So it's really important that an inquiry be made to see if it is in fact a genuine mistake. If it's a genuine mistake, it should not support a reversal based on Batson. And if it isn't, it is pretext. So how do we tell the difference?
If it isn't, it simply is pretext?
Well, it may be evidence of pretext.
You were lying?
It may be evidence of pretext if in fact it's not a genuine mistake. But the question is, how do we tell if it's a genuine mistake? And I think if you look at what the courts have done, you see that they've actually made this inquiry a number of times, and they've looked at a number of factors. So, for example, this court in the People versus George Williams case, one thing to look at, one factor to look at is the mistake explainable? And let me explain. Thank you, Your Honor. In the George Williams case, the prosecutor, there were two prospective jurors with the same last name, and the prosecutor mixed them up in statement of reasons. And the court said, that's understandable. That can be a race neutral. There's an explanation for that. Other courts have looked at, and particularly I'm thinking of the Ninth Circuit decision in Jamerson, where they looked at the question, does this mistake actually add to the Batson calculus or not? And let me explain what at least Jamerson meant. In Jamerson, the prosecutor said, I struck this juror because he said he had two brothers that were convicted of the same crime. And in fact, the juror only said he had one brother. And Jamerson said, okay, this is an innocent mistake. It didn't add to the calculus. It didn't add to the Batson calculus because one brother convicted of the same crime is enough of a logical reason. And then we look at to see, is it an isolated mistake? Because an isolated mistake, as Silva teaches us, shouldn't be enough. When you apply those factors here, this looks like pretext. It doesn't mean it is, but it looks like it. Is there an explanation for it? None has been offered. We don't have a situation like Williams where we have jurors with the same last name or an explainable mistake. Did it add to the calculus? It certainly did. This was one of the main reasons the prosecutor gave. And without this, which is conceitedly unsupported by the record, this reason drops out. He couldn't have relied on it.
Mr. Gardner, may I direct your attention to some other reasons given? And my preliminary question is, if the prosecutor gives four reasons, one of which is clearly applicable and valid, do we stop there? That's sort of a preliminary question. If there's a solid reason that the record supports that any prosecutor would want within reason to discharge the jury, is that enough?
The answer is no, and that gets us into mixed motive analysis.
Okay.
But as a matter of this case, Your Honor, that's not what we have, because each of the reasons stated.
I appreciate that point, and I'm going to bring you to some of the other each of the reasons. A bragger could simply, do you think a bragger, or somebody who brags, could they be punished whether or not they actually did it? And he said a bragger could be joking about something. Prosecutor didn't like that because the defendant's, I gather, defense was anticipated, in fact was, that he was just bragging when he said he committed the crime. So that's the first one. But then there was this question that, do you think the prosecution should carry a burden higher than proof beyond a reasonable doubt? And this juror and the other one too, but this one somewhat agreed. Would not that trouble any prosecutor?
Well, let me respond to the two questions Your Honor has referenced, and then we can talk about
sure,
mixed motive analysis. Although I'm at Your Honor's pleasure, I can talk about it in either
way. My pleasure is to hear what you're going to say.
In terms of the bragging question, that's question 58B. The question asked this. It said, if someone brags about something, doing something wrong, and they didn't do it, should they be nevertheless punished? Now, when you think about that question, we should want almost every juror in the state to say, no, you shouldn't be punished for something you didn't do. And in fact, 12 of the 16 jurors said, no, you shouldn't be punished. Mr. Carey was among them. Now, the prosecutors actually said that the answer to this question, and Mr. Carey actually wrote a sentence afterwards, he said they could be joking. The prosecutor said this was his primary reason for striking Mr. Carey. It's interesting to note when you look at that reason, Your Honor, that he didn't ask Mr. Carey a single question about it. He didn't ask any of the 12 white jurors that were seated a single question about it. What he did do was discharge Mr. Carey and leave the others seated. Miller L. teaches us that when a prosecutor says something is critical to their decision to strike a juror, the fact that they didn't even ask a single question is evidence of pretext.
But as a matter of tactics, when you're picking a jury and you know that there is at least a reasonable possibility that the other side has a theory, like maybe he was just joking, most advocacy teachers would say, for heaven's sakes, don't keep repeating the other side's theory. You don't want to spend a substantial part of your time in voir dire talking about their theory. Jurors tend to get confused that way, and then they remember that, oh yeah, there was a lot of talk about maybe he was joking, regardless of what the evidence is. So I'm hesitant to adopt a rule that simply says the prosecutor must be operating with a terrible motive if they didn't ask more questions about it. I think that there's a possibility for mischief there that interferes with legitimate advocacy. Let's put out right away that a violation of Wheeler-Batson is never legitimate advocacy. But we do have to allow advocates some reasonable latitude in the process of picking a jury as opposed to deciding who to excuse. Isn't that fair?
I think that is fair. And in terms of assessing whether a particular reason is genuine, if the prosecutor had genuinely been concerned about, and that's what we're trying to assess here, is there a genuine, was he genuinely concerned with this, or is it simply a pretextual reason? If the prosecutor had genuinely been concerned that jurors who thought he might be bragging wouldn't punish him if he didn't do it, the prosecutor would have had to ask someone something about this question. That's what Miller L. teaches. I appreciate that he may not want to repeat it all 12 times. But to discharge a juror and saying that the primary reason I discharged him is because of this answer, when you don't ask any of the white jurors that are seated a single question about that question, and you don't ask jurors Roscoe and Snedeker, who gave the same addition to their answer as Carey did, a single question about it, That, Miller L. teaches us, it's not a rule this court has to announce. Miller L. teaches us that is evidence of pretext.
I think that it may be evidence of pretext.
Yes.
There are any number of factual variations that can be evidence of a given outcome, in this case, pretext. What do we do? The trial court here made a finding that there was no pretext. Is that right?
The trial court made a global ruling after hearing the prosecutor's stated reasons that I think the exact language was the reasons are valid.
All right. And is that different in your analysis from saying there was no pretext?
No, I'm sorry, no.
Okay. Yeah. So the trial court on the ground, watching everything happen, having looked at the advocates and at the potential jurors, made a finding that there was no pretext, correct?
Yes.
I think we can both agree that the facts of Miller L. are way over the top, to use a legal term of art. They were exceptionally demonstrative of inherent racism in the system, arguably including the justices on the courts of review. What I'm worried about is, how broadly do we view our process of second-guessing a factual finding made by the trial court? This is not a circumstance, as in Miller L., where there was evidence that the prosecutor had a rule book that said, for heaven's sakes, don't keep any of these people on the jury. And where the evidence was rife with other examples of racism. I'm trying to figure out how we keep the boat afloat here.
Well, I think if one looks at Miller L., I appreciate Your Honor's legal observation that it was over the top. And I think that's a reference in Miller L. to the evidence of historic discrimination, the playbooks from the DA's office, the training manuals, and the history in that particular county. But when you look at the court's comparative juror analysis in Miller L., which they repeated in Snyder, which didn't have that same history, I think we have a good guide to how comparative juror analysis actually works, Your Honor. And that's the guide I would suggest that the court follow. Because what the state has done here is they have said, yes, okay, you've identified a number of white jurors that are seated that gave the same answer. But, the state says, they're not similarly situated. And the state says that because they look at other answers that the prosecutor didn't state as reasons for the Batson challenge. They look at other answers in the questionnaire and they say, look, they're different in these other questions. And we can talk about factually whether they're different or not. But there's a larger legal point, a predicate point, before you even take that step of looking at the facts. And that is to look at Miller L. And Miller L. said you cannot respond to comparative juror analysis by relying on reasons that the prosecutor at trial did not give.
But isn't that true with respect to the prosecutor's reasons for exercising a peremptory strike as opposed to conducting comparative juror analysis, particularly when the question of comparing jurors wasn't raised at the trial court, so the prosecutor has really never had any occasion or opportunity to explain what differences or similarities he may have seen between these jurors?
Sure, and the answer is no, it isn't. And let me explain why there isn't a distinction. I appreciate the distinction between looking at things the prosecutor didn't state to defend the strike as opposed to respond to comparative juror analysis. I also appreciate it in the context of a situation where the comparative juror analysis wasn't done at trial, and therefore the prosecutor didn't have a chance at trial. But let's look at the facts of Miller L. The comparative juror analysis in that case was not done at trial. So the prosecutor there did not have a chance to respond, just like the prosecutor here. Let me get to the other part of your question, which was, well, is there a difference between the reasons for the strike and a response to comparative juror analysis? If you look at that was exactly the argument that the state of Texas made in Miller L. and the dissenting opinions made in Miller L. That was exactly what they relied on. Let's take a step back and look at some of the facts of Miller L. The main white black juror that was discharged was a man named Mr. Fields. The defense position was that Mr. Fields was discharged improperly. The prosecutor at trial said he discharged him because of his views on rehabilitation. The defense then pointed to three non-black jurors that were seated, Ms. Hearns, Mr. Witt, Mr. Gutierrez, who had similar views on rehabilitation. And what the state of Texas did and what the dissent adopted was the state of Texas said, well, wait a minute. There's other questions in the questionnaire that show there's a difference between Hearns, Witt, and Gutierrez on the one hand and Mr. Field. This was responding to the comparative juror analysis. The dissent picked up on and said they're not similarly situated. And in footnote 4 of the majority opinion, Justice Souter absolutely rejected that. He absolutely rejected that. He said the dissent offers other reasons why these non-black panel members who expressed views on rehabilitation similar to Fields were otherwise more acceptable to the prosecution than he was. In doing so, the dissent focuses on reasons the prosecution itself did not offer.
But the prosecution, even now, would seldom say, well, let me tell you why I didn't excuse other people. They're being challenged to defend why they did excuse the people they excused. Now, if they are challenged at trial and someone says, well, wait a minute, you say you don't like people who work for the post office, but you kept 4 other postal employees, there may or may not be a valid response to that given. But seldom in the face of no challenge to the people you keep, does somebody say, let me tell you why I kept 5, 9, and 7.
That's absolutely correct, and I appreciate, Your Honor, the frustration inherent in that, because after all, the prosecutor here wasn't given a chance to point out why they're different. But that makes him no different than the trial prosecutor in Miller L, who also had no chance.
Here's my problem with that. It is true that in Miller L, the Supreme Court articulated as one factor among many analytical factors to determine whether or not there was pretext, comparative jury analysis.
Yes.
An interesting concept created by the United States Supreme Court, but they get to because they're the United States Supreme Court.
They do.
But in that case, it was one of a number of factors, and the other factors were so demonstrably demonstrated. Wow. That was bad, demonstrably demonstrated, that one could make the argument that the comparative jury analysis new concept was put out there, but certainly not necessary to the outcome. And here's my real question. Anybody who has, as opposed to all that preamble, anyone who's picked a jury knows that sometimes you are getting down to the end of the line and you may only have one peremptory left, or you're worried about somebody in the back. So you have two people, and if we want jurors to be selected as individuals, isn't it legitimate to say we can understand that even though these two people may both have the same answer that they've given, or a similar one, or a similar kind of family experience, or whatever, but this juror, on balance, is less of a risk for the advocate than this juror. It seems to me that if we begin to analyze these things like economists, we lose that reality, that there are some times when a juror says something that makes an advocate a little queasy, but there are other aspects of the totality of that person's presentation that makes them risk-worthy, whereas the other person is a bigger risk. It strikes me that that is a very demonstrable aspect of the process of picking a jury, and what do we make of that?
Well, let me respond to the preamble and the question as
okay.
Well, Your Honor. In terms of the preamble, in terms of Miller L., you're right, comparative juror analysis is just one tool to use to see if, in fact, pretext has been established. That's true. And Miller L. had others. This case has others, too, because let's take a look at juror Carey as a whole. We have the first reason is completely unsupported by the record and doesn't fit in to the criteria that allow us to excuse a mistake as a genuine mistake. We have the fact that the primary reason was the answer to 58B, and 12 other jurors gave almost the same answer, and none of them are questioned. That's a second factor, the failure to question on an area that's critical. Not only does he not question juror Carey, doesn't question the white jurors who are seated. That's another point of pretext. So it's not just one point. We then look at juror Allen. Would he have been a good juror for the prosecution? It sure looks that way. I mean, let's remember, juror Allen, his father was a cop. I'm sorry, prospective juror Carey. His father was a police officer for 30
years. Easy to make a mistake, isn't it?
It sure is. It sure is. And hopefully the court will find that this was genuine. The court can even do
I
a
have
sin-
no doubt.
The court could do a sincere and reasoned analysis to see that, in fact, it was genuine. My point about Juror Carey is that his father was a police officer for 30 years. He believed crime was one of the nation's biggest problems. He believed the major problem with the criminal justice system was that people do horrible crimes and get off lightly. He had no problems with the death penalty, and in fact, he thought the death penalty was appropriate for multiple murder, which was exactly the prosecutor's theory. So that's another factor that points toward pretext, as Miller L. and its progeny teach us.
And what about his answer to question 55J, which was alluded to earlier about reasonable doubt?
It was, and I'm sorry, Justice Warrior, it took this long to get back to the...
I knew you would.
...to the question. Well, I almost didn't. Let's talk about 55J. That was the question that talked about the standard of proof or the burden of proof. And basically what it did was it said, in a serious case, would you hold the prosecutor to a higher standard of proof than proof beyond a reasonable doubt? And agree or disagree. And Juror Carey somewhat agreed. And the prosecutor said, Juror Carey somewhat agreed with 55J. That's a good reason to strike him. The problem, when you do comparative jury analysis, is that there were two white jurors who strongly agreed with it, that were sitting on that jury.
Actually, I see in front of me that what the prosecutor said, the juror did somewhat agree, but the prosecutor said he strongly agreed.
Yes.
Now you're telling us two others did as well, but I just wanted to point that out.
And let me be clear, as Justice Corgan pointed out, one can make mistakes. In fact, that was a misstatement by the prosecutor.
Uh-huh.
That was a mistake by the prosecutor. That was an overstatement. Juror Carey did not strongly agree. Juror Carey somewhat agreed. And there were two white jurors who did strongly agree. A much less favorable from the prosecution perspective juror. And none of they were not stricken.
Were they questioned?
All three were questioned on.
And what did the white jurors say?
Actually, all three jurors said the same thing. When the prosecutor asked a question, said, you realize that the court will give you the law, you'll follow the law from the court, you won't impose your own standards. All three of them said, yes, of course. They all gave virtually identical answers to the question.
Yes, of course.
I'm not quoting exactly, Your Honor, but all of them assured the prosecutor that they wouldn't apply their own standard. They would apply the standard that came from the court.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you,
yes.
So we've discussed Miller L. a lot, but I think we'd all agree that Miller L. was overdetermined in certain ways. But Miller L. doesn't mark the, that's not a minimum threshold for finding a Batson violation.
I certainly hope not, Your Honor.
Yeah. It couldn't possibly be.
No.
Because we have Snyder. In Snyder, Snyder rested very principally also on a comparative juror analysis.
It did.
And do you recall, or was it apparent from the face of the opinion, whether or not the comparative juror analysis was urged at trial?
It was not.
It was not. So the was there any similar dynamic in terms of the court refusing to entertain possible differences between jurors?
Sure, and in fact there was. In Snyder versus Louisiana, the African-American jury issue was Mr. Jeffrey Brooks.
Yes.
The two white jurors upon whom the comparative juror analysis rested in Snyder was Mr. Laws and a Mr. Dons. As to Mr. Dons, and I've recently read the briefing in Snyder, the state took the same approach they took in Miller L. and the same approach the state takes here. They said, no, he's not similarly situated based on his availability for trial. That was the issue with Mr. Brooks.
Right.
Would he decide too quickly? Would he want to get out of there and therefore decide on a lesser? They said these others aren't similarly situated. Mr. Dons isn't similarly situated because there are other things about his questionnaire that are different and his white jurors are different. And again, just as in Miller L., even without all the additional evidence that we've talked about from Miller L., the history of discrimination, again, the Supreme Court held that that did not carry the day. That distinction in comparative juror analysis does not work. It did not work.
They refused to consider it, or did they just say it wasn't persuasive?
They did neither. They didn't address it at all.
They just
made a distinction.
It.
Not in the opinion. Not in the opinion.
It was argued, though.
It was argued.
Can you, can we move from Snyder and Miller L. to discussing what policy reasons or sort of what logical reasons might support a rule that would limit the comparative juror analysis undertaken for the first time on the telephone
yes.
review to the reasons that the prosecutor gave, presumably in the context just of explaining why the prosecutors exercised the strike against a particular prospective juror and not, as Justice Corgan said
yes.
earlier, it explained why they might have decided to keep some of their side jurors.
Yes, I think there's a tension here, and I appreciate the policy behind the questions of when the prosecutor hasn't had a chance. there's a concern here that, wait a minute, if the prosecutor hasn't had a chance, why shouldn't we allow the state to point out all sorts of different things that could have made a difference? And I get it. I really do get it. The problem is this, and I think this was the policy behind Justice Souter's opinion in Miller L. and the opinion in Snyder that didn't give credence to that argument. I think it's for this reason. If you accept the premise, as Miller L. and Snyder do, that comparative jury analysis is a useful tool, in a capital case with a 120-some-odd questions, given all the subparts, 120 questions, I would never, ever be able to establish comparative jury analysis pointing to pretext if the state is permitted to respond to the comparative jury analysis by pointing out differences that weren't articulated below by the prosecutor. Never. I have
Would you be able to? So I take that point, but it seems to me that there may be some difference between the kinds of differences that might be raised for the first time on appeal that, you know, may or may not be important to a particular prosecutor. You know, sort of the kinds of things that are maybe a little bit more whimsical or arbitrary. You know, sort of,
and
things that we commonly recognize as critical to how prosecutors generally exercise primary reason in broad-ranging cases.
And I think in making that determination, what Miller L. teaches us is that when we're trying to search for something that would have been critical to the prosecutor, the state's bats in motion, as I think the court puts it, stands or falls on the reasons that the prosecutor gave.
I think that is true, although you, as you said a second ago, you do recognize the tension here. Would you be amenable to a rule that was something more along the lines of reasonably apparent? Which is to say that, I mean, it seems a little obtuse to ignore obvious differences between jurors if they are staring you in the face, right? So there has to be some limitation on what the Supreme Court said in Miller L. I understand your point of view, which is that, yeah, I mean, given when you have the luxury of time and hindsight, you can come up with any number of possible differences by examining carefully the entire record and whatnot, but that's not actually what people in the heat of trial have time to do, and so they're acting on impulses that are a little less refined than that. So you have to kind of be cautious about that too. So that is a balance, it is a tension, and I don't think we can just say it's all one way or the other way then. So What's a reasonable rule in between?
Well, reasonably apparent or inconsistent with trial strategy would work as a compromise. And let's take a look at what that compromise would mean in this case. And I realize I've cut deeply into my rebuttal time, but I do want to answer the question, Your Honor. If we were to look at this case and look at what the state now says, well, these are the other things that are really important that distinguish him. This is why he didn't challenge, for example, Juror Snedeker, who gave the same answer as Juror Carey. And he points at the answers to questions 35 and 36 on the jury questionnaire. That's what my colleague does. 35 and 36 talked about contact with the law enforcement agencies. And it turned out the prospective juror, Snedeker, her father was a DA for 17 years. And the state argues reasonably that the prosecutor could have viewed her as someone with strong law enforcement contacts. Well, prospective juror Carey had a father who served as a cop for 30 years. So when you start backfilling and trying to look at these other things, the question is it consistent with a reasonable trial strategy? I don't think a prosecutor would say, okay, I'm going to leave this juror on because of really good law enforcement context. That's what's really motivating me. But this juror, whose father was a cop for 30 years, this juror's off. That to me it's not readily apparent as to why that would be so.
But and can we draw a distinction between the number and nature of the ties to law enforcement? So, only go to the prospective juror by their initials, but MAS, whose father had been a DA, also had a number of other close friendships and family members who were either judges or involved in law enforcement. Can we draw a distinction between somebody who has one close relative who's involved in law enforcement versus somebody who has a sort of larger social network?
It wasn't really a larger social network. I may have the initials wrong, but the juror. Juror S, I don't know her first name. Her father was a DA for 17 years, and she had a son that was applying for a law enforcement job. That was those are the only questions that my colleague has identified. That compared to a police officer for 30 years, I don't believe that really was the reason that the white juror who was concerned about bragging.
Well, see, here's my problem, and I appreciate the absolute candor with which you make that statement. I don't believe that was really the answer. then that means that we, with, from a great reserve from the time this case was tried, which was some time ago, that there are always some time ago, we now look at a cold record and say, we just don't believe it. We just don't believe that that's really what they meant. And so we are going to conclude that this officer of the court is a liar and a bigot. That's a very harsh judgment to me. And I think we can all agree that that's our first judgment. And so what I'm looking for is a way to articulate a rule and a way to look at this process, which is a vitally important process, in a way that honors both sides. And I don't mean both sides of advocacy, I mean both sides of the question. Because for us to be able to say decades later, well, gooey, we just don't believe it, that doesn't strike me as a real good legal standard. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and let's remember Miller L. was decades later and Snyder was decades later.
They were all decades later.
They were all decades later. And I think the first part, and I know I'm out of time, but I'll be happy to answer the question. I think the first part is to say this isn't about saying a prosecutor is racist. It isn't about that at all. It's a simple statement that race may have played a part in jury selection. That doesn't mean racist. It doesn't mean bigot. I know African-American prosecutors that have been charged with Batson violations. It simply reflects a view that a certain class of people may, on balance, be less inclined to impose death. I don't believe we would ever want to say when we reverse for a Batson violation that means this prosecutor is racist.
I think the standard from Miller L. on down is that the prosecutor was improperly motivated by racial bias.
And as
that sounds a lot to me like bigotry.
Well, but I think Your Honor knows what they're really saying is that they based a discharge of a prospective juror on race. That doesn't mean a prosecutor is a racist. It absolutely does not.
It just means they're acting on stereotype.
They're acting on a stereotype that they believe makes it more likely that they'll get a certain verdict. It is absolutely not about racism.
You're correct. Well over all of the time. But this is an important matter. We have a lot of questions, so on rebuttal you'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Lynette Winokur for the people. On the Batson issue, I think that before even going into a discussion of the details here, I would reiterate the point made that we are looking on appeal 30 years after trial at whether the trial court's ruling was clearly erroneous.
Would you have a different view of this if this were 2 years after trial?
Well, Your Honor,
I'm just wondering, what is the relevance of the 30-year comment?
I guess the relevance of the 30-year comment was going back to comments made about we're looking at a cold record. I mean, on appeal, whether it's
cold year, 2 years after, it's cold 30 years after.
Exactly, exactly.
So it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Well, it doesn't matter. It is a cold record regardless whether it's a year or 30 years. That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, so, it's not only a cold record. It doesn't have the comparative juror analysis wasn't done. So if you could address Mr. Gardner's issues with what we find here, comparative juror analysis, and why that doesn't succeed in terms of juror
care. Of course. Starting with Miller L., I won't rehash the facts except to reiterate that this court in People v. Lennox characterized the facts in Miller L. as being egregious, which the court has noted. There were also, I believe, 9 or 10 African-American jurors in that case which were excused. There was a policy throughout the DA's office to exclude African-American from African-American prospective jurors from veneer. And you also had a prosecutor who mischaracterized answers and ignored other answers. So this clearly is not the case in Miller L., but what one comment made or one statement made in Miller L., which is valid here and any time we raise a Batson-Miller claim, which is comparative juror analysis is simply one relevant circumstance that we consider when we're looking at a Batson-Wheeler claim. So in this case, because we are necessarily restricted, because a comparative juror analysis was not made below, we have to look at the four seated jurors who were pointed out by defense counsel, and they were all, just use the last names without meaning any disrespect, but they were Roscoe, Snedeker, Willamas, and Sherelle. And even if we assume for purposes of argument that the answers that they gave on the jury questionnaire were similar or even exactly the same, there were various factors which offset the answers to those questions, which distinguished those four jurors from Mr. Carey.
Would you address the bragging issue, which Mr. Gardner spent a great deal of time talking about?
Yes. The prosecutor here enunciated that the two main reasons for exercising the peremptory against Mr. Carey were the fact of how he answered the question regarding whether somebody could be bragging, should they be punished.
And the answer is no, and should be no, right? But he went on to say they could be joking. Now, that's reason to discharge the juror?
Well, that's one factor that we look at. And the thing is when we're looking at a claim on appeal, a Batson-Wheeler claim, we don't look at the answer to one question in isolation.
The other question was that he somewhat agreed that the prosecutor, although the prosecutor perhaps honestly misunderstood and thought he strongly agreed that the prosecutor's burden would be greater. Now, we have other jurors that also strongly agreed the prosecutor's burden should be higher.
Yes, as I was saying.
And you thought that bragging, you should not be punished just for bragging.
Yes, and even if we assume for purposes of arguments, let's say we're looking at the four jurors, the four white seated jurors who were called out in the appellant's opening brief. If we look at those four jurors, and even if we assume for purposes of argument that several of their answers were either the same as Mr. Carey's, there were other factors that came out during voir dire and other factors that were laid out in the questionnaire, which distinguished them from Mr. Carey. You had Ms. Roscoe and Ms. Sherelle, who were both much more emphatically, their views on the death penalty were much more emphatic as compared to Mr. Carey's. You had Ms. Snedeker, who not only was her father a district attorney for 17 years, and her son was seeking employment in law enforcement, but she also had several family friends who were deputy DAs. So that's at least four people, that she had ties to four people, close ties, that were in law enforcement, as compared to Mr. Carey, who only had his father, who had been a police officer. You had Ms. Rolamas, who answered several questions on the questionnaire more emphatically than Mr. Carey, and those had to do with the tattoos and the motorcycle gangs, which were directly relevant to this case because of the defendant's lifestyle. And you had, again, Ms. Sherelle, whose answers were much more emphatic. And I would point out that the prosecutor in this case at least once stated to the court that he was concerned about potential jurors who had kind of ambivalent attitudes in general and also with respect to the death penalty. And while the prosecutor here was questioning Mr. Allen, the second African-American juror, he extensively questioned, I think it was at least six pages of the transcript, he extensively questioned Mr. Allen on his views as to the requisite burden of proof in this case, because he was concerned that Mr. Allen required or believed that he would hold the prosecutor to a higher standard of proof. The trial court, halfway through the voir dire, kind of jumped in and kind of helped the questioning along, I guess, to a certain extent, by instructing on the burden of proof and what would be required in this case, because I believe Mr. Allen said something about wanting to know to a certainty within himself that the defendant was guilty.
Well, at this point, I personally am more concerned about the juror that we have initials
with
his last name.
Okay. So I guess going back to Mr. Carey and some of the comments made by defense counsel, which I'd like to address, are I understand that defense counsel argued that Mr. Carey appeared to be a good juror, his father was an officer, but the focus here on appeal is not whether the prosecutor's choices were objectively reasonable. The question we're asking on appeal is whether the trial court believed that the prosecutor's reasons for excusing this particular juror were race neutral.
All right, so we have a trial court who did believe that, and our standard of review is deference to the trial court. What does this do with comparative juror analysis? In every single case, won't there always, no two people are identical, won't there always be identifiable distinctions that hypothetically would justify retaining one and discharging the other?
Well, I think you're right, Your Honor. That's one limitation on a comparative juror analysis, especially when we're doing it and it hasn't been done below. And that's why I think, because of the fact that comparative juror analysis is just one part of the equation, because we're looking at all the relevant circumstances, because we're looking at words on a page, and we still have to consider what the trial court saw when he was participating, or the trial judge, when he was participating in voir dire, when he was watching the prosecutor question.
So it's more than words on a page if we're giving deference.
Exactly. The reason that we give deference, and this court has said repeatedly that, this court has acknowledged that a prosecutor can even use, you know, the length of a prospective juror's hair, and that we shouldn't be second-guessing the choices made by a prosecutor when the trial judge was in the best position to...
Well, how do we distinguish between giving deference and abdicating?
Well, I think if you have a situation, so going back to Miller L., where you have a situation where the court in Miller L., the high court, stated, okay, comparative juror analysis is one relevant circumstance that we look at. But in that case, it was so egregious that it basically took
over.
What
about Snyder? Miller L. is too easy to talk about. What about Snyder?
Well, Snyder, I believe, was the case where the court rejected the claim that the comparative juror analysis distinguished the white and African-American jurors, if I'm correct.
No, Snyder was the case where the court held it was a Batson violation because there was a comparison between the juror who was struck and two white jurors who were similarly situated. And the court said, you know, this is unexplainable. It didn't actually go into a very lengthy analysis. It's actually a pretty brief opinion. It didn't conjure all the possible permutations about how these jurors might have been different. It just focused on the relevant characteristic, which was that Mr. Brooks was said to, you know, was said to be someone prone to rush through the trial because he had a part-time teaching job and he wanted to get back to the teaching job. And, you know, the court found this basically fallacious because there were two other jurors who also had time commitment issues, but the prosecutor didn't strike them.
Well, I'm not aware of, besides those characteristics of the three jurors, I'm not aware of whether there were any other characteristics of those three jurors which distinguished them. But if, in
fact... Well, Mr. Gardner says that the state did argue that, but the court did not take the bait. Maybe this is going too far into the weeds. I guess I want to get to the underlying question, which is, even if you say, your briefing, you know, has a lot of this distinguishing information between the black juror in question here and the others. Even if we accept that there are these differences, right, you would still have to agree that ultimately what the analysis is focused on is imputing to the prosecutor the consideration of those factors, right? Because it is the subjective frame of mind that the prosecutor has at the time of the strike that is the relevant data point, ultimately. So, even if we post hoc do all this comparative juror analysis, point to all these differences, the point is you are imputing all those differences to the mind of the prosecutor at the time. Now, that's kind of a hard thing to do, right? Because we don't, as has been said from the other angle in this case, we don't know what's going on in the mind of the prosecutor. So now, just as we can't lightly infer discrimination, we also can't lightly infer that the prosecutor is taking into account all the myriad subtle differences between jurors. So my suggestion is, why wouldn't we limit this kind of consideration post hoc to just those that are, in some sense, obvious, meaning they're reasonably apparent, that the factors that are kind of jumping out from the page, which a reasonable prosecutor would not have been unaware of. But we can't parse that too finely, because then we're in the business of imputing to the prosecutor things that he or she may or may not have thought. And that seems an odd thing to do.
Well, I understand.
It can cut both ways, too.
I understand that. However, when you're looking at a Batson-Willard claim and we're giving the trial court who presided over the proceedings, I don't know if I should use the term benefit of the doubt, but...
We give the trial court deference, right.
Because the trial court is sitting in the courtroom, and especially in a capital case like this, when you have proceedings which are so so prolonged. I mean, jury voir dire took weeks in this case. So you have a trial court who's watching both the defense attorney and the prosecutor. This case itself, I mean, between in limine motions and trial was at least 6 months long when you're talking about voir dire. So I guess my answer to your question about wanting to make it only items that are readily apparent from the record, I feel would actually obliterate or at least minimize the trial court's role in this.
Okay? Well, let's just focus on this trial court. Was this trial court alert?
This trial court was very alert, as I was saying. So the trial court at a certain
point... Did the trial court call out the unsupported comment about prejudice?
The trial court did not call that out, but under this...
That doesn't seem alert.
Well, that's jumping to the conclusion that because the trial court didn't answer a question, it didn't understand the proceedings. But under this court's opinion in People v. Wheeler, the trial court isn't necessarily required to ask questions when the trial court believes that the reasons rendered by the prosecutor are race neutral and that they are subjectively genuine. So there's no requirement that the trial court ask questions. And there's
you nothing... You don't disagree that the allusion to prejudice was unsupported by the record?
No, we have acknowledged
that. So your position is just that the trial court was in a sense given the discretion to just bypass that comment and just sort of say, oh, well, you know, I noticed it, but I'm not going to comment on it? I mean, that's a little bit odd.
Well,
I mean, one of the central aspects of Batson analysis is to examine whether reasons given are supported by the record.
Well, in the first instance, I would actually disagree that this was actually a reason given to support the exercise of the challenge against Mr. Carey, because in our brief, we discussed the fact that when the defense attorney makes the Batson-Wheeler challenge, the prosecutor kind of leads in, and it's our view that the reading of the record is that the prosecutor is leading in, we're on the same page, we're talking about Mr. Carey, and then he goes on to say, the reasons I exercised my challenge were this. So the fact, now he did make a mistake as far as identifying who they were talking about, but the record does not read that he used that as one of the reasons for exercising the peremptory. The two reasons he used were the question about the bragging and the fact that he believed that Mr. Carey would require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So that wasn't, while it was a mistake, it wasn't relied on by the prosecutor in our reading of the record. And that goes back to appellant's counsel talking about the mistake being evidence of pretext. I mean, there is nothing to show that a simple mistake is evidence of a pretext, especially in light of the fact that he at least proffered two race-neutral reasons to the trial court.
Can I ask you about the second one, the just very specific question mm-hmm. about the reasonable doubt mm-hmm. part? Mr. Garner says that there were two other jurors who also answered similarly, in fact, strongly agreed. Is that true, and what do we do about those two jurors?
Well, the two jurors that answered similarly to Mr. Carey weren't necessarily, just because those answers to one
let's,
of the
let's just be clear to you, Mr. Carey answered somewhat agreed, did he not?
I believe so.
And the other two jurors answered strongly agreed?
Yes, but when we're looking at whether there was a race-neutral explanation, we're looking at kind of all the factors.
Okay.
So even if those answers were either the same or even stronger in favor of, let's say, the prosecutor keeping those jurors, and I won't go over the factors again because I discussed them here and in our brief, there were at least those four jurors that were brought out by defense counsel on appeal. There were other factors which offset the fact that those answers might have been similar or even stronger for those four jurors. So we're looking at kind of a whole package of all the relevant circumstances. And I would also point out when we're looking at the relevant circumstances, one circumstance that counsel did not mention is the fact that this court has said, at least in People v. Turner, this court looked at the race of the defendant, the race of the victim, and the race of the remaining jurors on the panel. And I think that that's important here because you have a white defendant, you have three white victims, and you have, as the prosecutor mentioned, a defendant who was a white supremacist. So.
Is there actually any, is there any evidence in the record that he was a white supremacist? I know that there was a mention of that.
There was mentioned at the point of voir dire or at trial, because at trial, evidence came out that he had a knife with a Nazi swastika on it. And that was actually discussed at trial by at least one witness, I believe a police officer, and also this girl from Brandy Homan, who was the one who hid the clothing after the third murder, and with the bloody clothing after the Robertson murder was a knife with a Nazi
swastika. So is the implication of that fact that certainly it wouldn't be a racial, black racial decision to excuse two black jurors because they would be favorable to the prosecution?
On one hand, they would, but because we're looking at all the circumstances.
Well, I understand, but bringing up the defendant was a white racist, are you arguing it supports the race-neutral discharge by the prosecutor?
Yes, Your Honor. And actually, it is a point that was raised by the prosecutor when the Batson-Wheeler motion was first made.
Do we have case law that says if the victim and the defendant are of one race and the discharged suspect class is of another, that weighs in?
Well, I believe in People versus Turner, this court looked at the fact in finding a violation that the defendant was African-American, and that the victim was white, and that the remaining jurors remaining on the panel were white. So it did consider race in determining whether the prosecutor's reasons in exercising the peremptory challenges.
And they decided there the prosecutor abused his use of peremptory challenges?
I believe there was an abuse in that case.
So you've talked about several factors for us to consider under all the circumstances, and you started with saying that comparative juror analysis is one factor, and we're not going to distinguish how you believe the record reflects that four white jurors who remained on the jury were different, right, by depth and emphasis in their answers. And then I also heard you speak to deference, the cold record, the court's observation in voir dire over a capital case. And I've heard you talk about factors, the race of the defendant and the victims to the jurors who are excused. Are there other factors that we look at that you can think of in terms of this? And I say that because comparative juror analysis, when it's not raised at the trial court level, creates problems for us on review when questions haven't been asked and it's hard to make inferences from.
Yes, it is difficult, obviously, and we're necessarily restricted by that. I think those were the major factors that we looked at. Again, I guess going back to the trial court.
Well,
and the
can I ask you a question? I think a factor I've read previously in some of our case law, and that is the timing of the peremptory?
That would be a factor. And in this case, the prosecutor actually exercised the two peremptories kind of pretty much towards the beginning of voir dire, which further supports the fact that it was not, I mean, further supports the fact that the exercise was based on race-neutral reasons, and that is because...
And do you recall how many jurors were questioned?
In total?
Yes.
I don't know that number.
Does 160 sound familiar?
I would imagine it was somewhere up there. I mean, in a capital case, it's quite extensive, and I know it lasted several weeks. So
so the voir dire process itself lasted several weeks?
Yes, and so obviously, someone who has tried a case, who engages in voir dire, especially like a case like this, presumably a prosecutor and or a defense attorney would be a little more free when they're exercising the peremptories at the beginning of the process. Of course, as the process kind of winds down and there are less peremptories available, both the prosecutor and the defense attorney would probably exercise maybe a little more restraint when they are exercising peremptory challenges. And because the fact that this occurred pretty much at the beginning supports the fact that the prosecutor was pretty much looking at the prospective jurors to determine, okay, did this offset that one? Or using it, I guess, in a more liberal manner that he might have maybe even like 2-3 days later.
Right, so if you get down to peremptories, they're looking over their shoulder or looking at the questionnaire to determine who's left.
Exactly.
In terms of the concession of prejudice, that in fact either wasn't a reason that the prosecutor relied on for purposes of excusing juror Perry, and or the fact that the prosecutor was mistaken because when juror Perry spoke about his father being a law enforcement officer in Louisiana, 1960s, he didn't raise prejudice. Did the defense object to that at the time in speaking to that prejudice was not, so everyone missed
no,
that?
No, everyone missed it. Everyone missed that. And I guess the last thing, I wanted maybe 2 minutes on the requested district council. So the last thing I wanted to say on the Batson-Wheeler claim is that it's important on appeal not to necessarily look at who would have made a good juror and whether the prosecutor's choices were objectively reasonable reading the record, but again, that we need to look at whether there was substantial evidence to support the trial court's conclusion that the prosecutor's reasons were race neutral. One other point on that is, although the prosecutor jumped in and gave the court his reasons for excusing these two jurors, the trial court actually ruled that there was no prima facie case, and then that the reasons were valid. So although we are going to engage on the third prong of the Batson inquiry regardless, I do think the fact that the trial court specifically said that there had not been a prima facie case made further supports the conclusion that the trial court believed that the prosecutor's reasons were subjectively
Spruce.
Genuine. Quickly on the requested discharge attorney, defense counsel.
Can't hear you.
Less than 2 weeks before this motion or statement was made by the defendant to the trial court, the defendant was asked expressly by the trial court if he wanted to keep Mr. Campbell as attorney, and he expressly stated that he wanted to keep him as an attorney. Less than 2 weeks later, he not only did not clearly indicate he wanted to discharge his attorney, but he actually twice clearly indicated to the trial court that he wanted to keep Mr. Campbell because he was afraid of who he might get. Even if this court interprets the statement that the defendant made to the court as a request to discharge his attorney, under the two Ortiz factors, and especially the second Ortiz factor, his request, should it be interpreted that way, was clearly untimely because the first witness had started testifying in the penalty phase. He didn't name any attorney, so presumably there was nobody there to step in on the attorney's shoes. And so, under this court's recent opinions in People versus Maciel and Verdugo, this would have been untimely.
So it doesn't matter in your view.
Hello?
The trial court mentioned the Marsden
yes.
Center and Ortiz?
Well, it doesn't
can.
Matter in the
What's
sense
up?
That this court and also the court in Lara still went through the analysis and said, okay, this court erroneously referenced the Marsden standard, but we're going to look at it under the Ortiz standard. Because even though a defendant has the right to
yes,
retain counsel,
yes, you don't have to touch
choice,
anything. You should
right.
never have to provide that
password. And we
need to
look at whether the defendant will be prejudiced and or actually, we need to look at whether the defendant will be prejudiced or whether there will be
Verizon,
disruption of the orderly
Betty.
Processes of justice because it's untimely. Based on the facts in this case, because it was a death penalty case and the trial had already started.
No, wrong,
under this
wrong,
decisions
wrong.
In Maciel,
you are waiting for the new credit card. As soon as you get the new credit card, you need to log into your Verizon account and you need to update the payment information in the auto pay section.
And if there are any other questions, I would submit.
Then you'll have to do it tomorrow.
Thank you, Your Honor, I believe I have 5 minutes, even if it's not honest. And I hope desperately to get to make. Thank you. I hope desperately to get to mixed motive analysis, which I didn't have a chance to cover. But the Attorney General has suggested various factors distinguishing prospective juror Carey from Cheryl, Riamas, Snedeker, and Roscoe, and she has identified things that the prosecutor
yes.
didn't identify. I'm not going to repeat by the discussion of Miller L. and why I think that's
sure,
improper.
Sure, why not?
She has made no attempt to distinguish footnote 4, which is, I think, the key footnote in Miller L. And let me just say this. I have an experienced and skilled advocate on the other side of this podium.
Okay.
And I admire her zeal, and I admire the brief she
all
wrote.
Right.
But it doesn't, and with all respect, it doesn't take a skilled or zealous or even a good advocate to look at a 120-question questionnaire and come up with things that make someone different. No one is going to answer that questionnaire the same. I believe that the reason Miller L reached the result it reached is because it knew that any other result, perhaps mitigated by the reasonable suggestion that you made, Justice Rule, about, I think, the reasonably apparent limitation. Any other result drives a truck through comparative juror analysis. You cannot do it on appeal if you allow that approach. And that's why Miller L in footnote 4 did not allow that approach. The court, the Attorney General suggested that I have focused on the fact that Juror Carey would be a good juror for the prosecution. She suggested that since this was on appeal, it wasn't perhaps relevant. I just want to assure the court that I have made many things up in my career, but I'm not making this one up. It's at page 247 of the majority opinion. The Miller L majority looks at the fact that a juror would have been a good juror for the prosecution. And the prosecution.
Well, who gets to make that call?
Well, it's a good question.
Whether it's 2 decades later or 2 years later, it strikes me that if you're not trying the case, it's blithe to say, oh, well, they should have loved this juror. There are so many factors that go into picking a jury. And, Mr. Gardner, I would venture to say that if you and I were trying exactly the same case on exactly the same side, we might very well differ as to whether or not either of us would want to keep this juror. So I am a little frustrated by the, it smacks of, why don't they just take the first 12?
I appreciate the comment. The problem is this, is that I didn't make it up. Miller L does look at that factor and says, in fact, Juror Field should have been an ideal juror for the prosecution. And so Your Honor's point, well, who gets to make that decision, could just as easily have been made to the Miller L majority. And the answer is, the court does. And if you look, and I agree with you that around the edges it may be hard, but it isn't hard as to Juror Carey. Just a moment ago, the Attorney General mentioned that there was evidence that, or the prosecutor believed there was going to be evidence, that in fact my client was a white supremacist. If you believe that there's going to be a white supremacist evidence about the defendant, wouldn't you want an African-American juror on, especially if that juror's father was a police officer for 30 years, that juror believed in the death penalty for multiple murder cases, the juror believed crime was the biggest problem facing the nation, and the problem with the criminal justice system was that people did terrible crimes and got off lightly. I agree with you, around the edges, there may be disputes as to whether a juror was good for the prosecution, but there is no dispute as to Juror Carey. He would have been a good juror for the prosecution.
There's one thing there that is a little twist. One reason, in your view, that he would have been a good juror for the prosecution is that he was black and the defendant was a white supremacist.
Yes.
So, arguably, that positive detracts from a racial reason for discharging. His race was a positive thing, so there must have been other things could be the conclusion.
I agree.
In other words, Mr. Gardner, how was your client injured?
I agree with you. There are two competing inferences to be drawn from the fact that a juror, either by virtue of their race or by virtue of their specific answers, is a good one for the prosecutor. Here, I think we have both by virtue of his answers and by virtue of his race. And so there are two competing inferences. One is, wow, this juror would have been really good for the prosecution, so the prosecutor must have had a darn good reason to excuse
him. Which the trial court concluded, and we're reviewing the trial court's conclusion.
And we'll certainly get to the deference question in a moment, but that's right. The other inference, and the one that Miller L. drew, is this juror would have been an ideal juror for the prosecution. There must be something wrong with the fact that they're discharged when you add up all the other factors.
You're going to get to deference?
That's I am right now, Your Honor.
No, I want to help you there.
Oh. Thank you. And the question of deference was raised. My colleague from the Attorney General said that the court has held it. I think the example was a trial court doesn't need to ask questions of an Attorney General. And that's true in part, but it's also wrong in part. This court in Silva said that when a trial prosecutor offers reasons in a Batson hearing that are plausible and supported by the record, there is no need for a particular colloquy in order for us to give deference. But Silva went on, and they said, when the reasons given are unsupported by the record or implausible, then we require the trial court to make a probing inquiry in that situation. Silva has never been overruled. I understand that the question of deference has been the subject of some dispute in the court's opinions. I get that. But the actual facts of Silva have never been overruled.
But if I can just say, because this does trouble me, if on the face of it the reasons are, what was the phrase you used, you don't need to have an inquiry, are plausible, here they were, and it's only becomes troublesome when you get into the comparisons.
Yes.
So on the face of them, they were plausible, fine.
Well, certainly one wasn't plausible. Recalled and spoke of prejudice. It's at page 265.
Okay, but all right.
That's unsupported by the record, and that's the exact situation where Silva says the trial court, since it's unsupported by the record, the trial court has an obligation to ask probing questions. None
well, but
were asked
the,
here.
We were agreeing that the district attorney just misspoke. It was a good faith. So could the, is the trial court supposed to be more on top of what happened a few weeks ago in the voir dire?
More on top than...
That he didn't speak of prejudice?
Oh, absolutely he's required to. That's exactly what Silva says. That's exactly the situation in Silva. The DA said, gave a reason that didn't exist, and this court said that's not entitled to deference because there were no probing questions asked. And I think the chief, you asked a question that said, was anyone else aware of it? Everyone missed it. And that's true. But it wasn't defense counsel's obligation under Silva to do a reasoned and fair analysis. It was the trial court's.
I agree with that. But doesn't that mean then, though, that... 2 to 4 weeks of voir dire,
160
people?
No, gosh, I can't imagine why that inference. It could just as easily have been exactly what Miller L. says. A mischaracterization can be evidence of pretext, and that's why you have a probing inquiry.
What do we do with the presumption, and it is repeated numerous times in our case law, that we presume that all lawyers follow the rules? And if that, and that is certainly a rebuttable presumption, some would argue it's naive, but it's only a rebuttable presumption.
Stop. Come here.
Isn't it enough to say, well, it could have been this? To simply say, we assume that advocates know the rules of ethics and follow them and are making a good faith effort to pick a jury that is at least open to their side of the case. Because there's a theory that you don't actually pick a jury, you deselect a jury. Then it strikes me that it may not be enough to say, well, it could have been this.
So
it could have been lots of things.
You may, as soon as she finishes, when I apologize, you may answer the question.
And no save by the bell, Your Honor. I don't believe that's the case, and I don't believe it should be the case.
What should not be the case?
Well, the idea that we are going to defer in all situations, I think Silva, to me, represents the appropriate balance. In most situations, Silva says, we are going to defer, and we're going to assume that people are doing things that they should be doing. So a trial court has there's no reason to look any further if the reason is plausible and supported by the record. But in the situation where the reason is not supported by the record, to simply apply the presumption Your Honor has identified allows a prosecutor in a situation to simply come up with a reason that's not supported by the record, and these presumptions will save the prosecutor from any kind of analysis, even when the trial court makes no probing inquiry at all. And that's why I think Silva strikes the right balance. In this case, if you apply the balance struck by Silva, no deference is
Could you just give us your two sentences on mixed motive before you leave the podium?
Your Honor, may I?
Very briefly.
Okay, two sentences on mixed motive analysis. Prior to 2008, there were three possible choices for mixed motive analysis. Since 2008, the decision in Snyder, there were really two. One of them was set forth by Justice Marshall in a dissent years ago in a case out of Texas, Wilkerson case, and he said, if race plays any role in the governmental decision, that's it, game over. That rule has been adopted by a number of state courts. The other, in light of Snyder said, we recognize this view, and we don't have to resolve the question here in Snyder because it played a substantial role, and that's enough. So that's the minimum. We don't know if ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court will resolve this at a higher standard, but we know if it's a substantial role. This court faced the question in Schmeck, People versus Schmeck, and left the question open, and it has in subsequent cases as well. So we know that at the very least, under Snyder, we know that if it plays a substantial role, that's enough. The Justice Marshall's view may end up carrying the day. I think it should. This court in Schmeck talked about that view and noted that what it really comes from is other governmental decisions. We don't allow race to play any role in housing, for example, or employment. We just don't allow it, nor should we allow it here. But even if the higher threshold were required here, we have Juror Carey, who I believe is not around the edges and actually would have been a very good juror for the prosecution. We have one reason that is unsupported by the record without any of the criteria. It's not explained. It's never probed. We have another reason that applies to 12 of the 16 seated jurors. We have him saying that the primary reason was 58B, and he doesn't ask a single question of juror Carey of 58B or any of the other jurors of 58B. And we have 55J that applies to at least two other white seated jurors. On this record, applying the mixed motive analysis from Snyder, I believe there is a Batson violation.
Thank you.
It wasn't quick, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Thank you anyway. The matter is submitted.